Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky and several key European allies go to Washington to make their case to President Trump for ending the war in Ukraine. Moscow has its own demands and red lines.
Russia is a villain in the Western mind and Western imagination, and Russia is an aggressor in Ukraine. It does have legitimate grievances.
I'm Marco Werman. What Vladimir Putin wants now in Ukraine. Also today, you don't need to smell burning plastics to know they're bad.
They can cause reproductive issues, hormonal issues. Some of them can cause cancer. They can cause immune dysfunction.
Plus, thousands of ancient manuscripts returned to Timbuktu and Mali. But will they be safe again?
It's a symbolic move by the government to move them back to showcase the really control the situation in Timbuktu.
All those stories for you and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment, and we'll be back in the co-host chair later this week. We begin today with the war in Ukraine. Rescue workers in the northeastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv carried an injured woman out of a heavily damaged apartment building. At least seven people there were killed in a Russian strike, including one child, according to Reuters. Elena Yakusheva is in Kharkiv and described the area as residential, with families, young children, and a playground. The Russian attack took place hours before European leaders landed in Washington to accompany Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky for a highly anticipated meeting with President Trump at the White House. In a joint appearance this afternoon, Zelensky thanked Trump for working toward ending the war.
So we need to stop this war, to stop Russia, and we need support, American and European partners. We will do our best for this.
Over the weekend, Trump dropped his demand for a ceasefire in Ukraine and pushed for a full-blown peace deal instead. But the question is, a peace deal on whose terms? For some insight into how the Kremlin views this moment and the future of Ukraine, we reached out to Nina Khrushcheva. She's a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She's also the great-granddaughter of the late Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. Nina Khrushcheva says today's meetings in Washington look very different from Moscow's perspective.
I think it's a bit of a kind of show, I think, that most of Europe is going to the United States as well to hold Vladimir Zelensky's hand, as the Russians see it. But they are very calm about today. They basically, Putin said what he wants. And so I think we just have to wait until this day passes and whether Vladimir Zelensky would agree to some of the demands that Putin makes, and most of them is that the Donbas region that Russia occupies at about, I mean, there's different information, 80 to 75% would then be totally given to Russia in exchange to freezing the connection line, the war line that is between Russia and Ukraine right now.
Can you elaborate a bit more on how the Alaska summit did go well for Putin? Like, in what ways did it go well?
There was a red carpet. The two presidents left the planes almost together. Sort of there's some sort of coordination. Donald Trump was standing and waiting on the red carpet for Putin. He even clapped. I think they took down that moment from the White House video, but it was something that he was welcoming Vladimir Putin's conversation. It was only about 3 hours, so it wasn't going for six or seven as the Russians said it would. But it seemed that Putin made himself heard. They parted quite well. They had a press conference. It was kind of pro forma. But then Donald Trump said, well, it went great. It was 10 out of 10. So it was wonderful. And in fact, Vladimir Zelensky would have to sign some deals. And it's up to him. And he can end the war immediately if he gives up Crimea. So it does seem that basically Putin stood firm and Donald Trump accepted his standing.
I'm curious how those moments are playing out in Russia right now. Do you know what Russian media have made of the Alaska summit?
Basically, of course, they welcome the red carpet. Basically, of course, they welcome the idea that Putin came to the American soil and the American president welcomed him, which, given the 3.5 years since the war began, Russia was in the Western world. It was, of course, much less of a pariah, despite the Western insistence it was on the outside world, in the world that is not Western. But in the Western world, the Western-affiliated world, as Japan, South Korea, he was a persona non grata. He was the kind of James Bond villain of every James Bond film put together. And so suddenly he comes to America and the American president is welcoming him and says, "Dear friend Vladimir." So absolutely, the Russians were ecstatic. He was meeting him, and that was important. Trump was meeting Putin as his equal. So the Russians were happy. The Russians were also happy that nothing was signed, because Russians, especially hardcore Russian nationalists, the right-wingers, they think it's the West that is going to dupe Russia, and Russia will stop the war, and then the West will continue to expand NATO, and so they're happy that Putin didn't sign anything, but Trump agrees to continue the conversation.
So President Trump's public position going into talks today with Volodymyr Zelensky and his European backers at the White House, it seems to mirror key Russian demands on Ukraine. Trump has stopped pushing for a ceasefire and dismissed joining NATO as an option for Ukraine. Where do you see the big differences between Washington and Moscow when it comes to ending this war?
We talk about NATO as if, or no NATO for Ukraine, as if it's, well, we don't talk, but some talk as if it's today's demand. It hasn't been. I mean, Trump right away said that there would be no NATO for Ukraine. So it's not, that is not a new one. But the fact that he moved from the ceasefire, which before, just a few weeks ago, he was saying, well, you know, there's useless talking to Putin. He agrees and then he doesn't agree. We need immediate ceasefire. And suddenly he doesn't need immediate ceasefire. So suddenly he talks about larger peace, which is basically what Putin wanted since January 20th.
Let me go back to something you said a moment ago, that Russia thinks the U.S. will dupe Russia. Can you tell me more about that?
I mean, let's go back to the NATO story. When East Germany and West Germany were uniting, there was a promise to Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO is not going to move an inch to the east. And then suddenly it moved an inch to the east and more inches to the east, and basically very close to Russia. And so, of course, they think that the United States is going to dupe Russia because it doesn't think that Russia is an equal partner. And because it's an equal partner, if Russia is weak, the United States is going to manipulated. So it is a mistrust on both sides. And it is important to understand that although Russia is a villain in the Western mind and Western imagination, and Russia does act illegally in many ways, and Russia is an aggressor in Ukraine, it does have legitimate grievances. And normally these grievances are dismissed. And even I'm always, not always, but often asked, does Russia really think that we are going to, we the West, we are going to be a threat to? It's like, yes, Russia does think that.
I guess what I want to hear from you is, what do you think Putin thinks he's giving in on? Where does he see the risk in these negotiations?
Well, if you ask the Russians, I mean, I can only say that. If you ask the Russians, they would say, we are negotiating and we are winning on a battlefield. It's slow, but we are, and we can take all the time in the world, and we will take all the time in the world because we are not, I mean, one of the very famous songs of World War II is that Russia will pay any price. And so we are going to pay any price for this. And because we're negotiating, we're already giving something. So we're willing to have this conversation. He needs Donbass because that was the original promise of 22. So he would either get Donbass by negotiations or he would continue going until they get to the border. And he would potentially, I don't know if it's going to happen because, as I said, he also cannot be trusted, or not also, he cannot be trusted. But for now, his argument supposedly is that if the whole Donbass region is given to Russia, then other parts, the Zaporizhia region and the Kherson region, not taken fully, but will not be pushed to be taken fully. So the connecting line, the front line is going to be frozen. So he feels that to end the war, which Ukraine is losing more than Russia does, he's willing to make these concessions.
That's Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs and the great-granddaughter of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. We turn to her frequently for insight into how major events are being discussed inside Russia. When we spoke this morning about the negotiations over Ukraine, I also asked how closely average Russians are paying attention to the war. Here's Nina again.
It's a very complicated issue because on one hand, Russians are dialed in because there is a war. But at the same time, Russians fight so hard not to be part of it and not have their everyday life being run by the war. In fact, the more the war is pushed on them, the more they're fighting to pretend that their life is normal. So probably 20% fully support the war, 50% basically want to be left alone, and 30% quietly and not so quietly don't support it. You cannot be not that quiet. But if you travel around Russia, which I've done in recent years, there's some incredible things of kind of support for Ukraine. They're quiet, but they're also visible. The balloon display of yellow and blue at the store. And, you know, I ask a person, how is it? Like, isn't she afraid to be arrested? And she's like, oh, and I will just say these balloons look so well together. And I will have a Marilyn. And it was so funny. She said, I will have a Marilyn Monroe smile when I say that. Wow. If somebody would come and ask. So it's a very complex picture. And also Russians had never, now all the wounded are coming back. Not all, many wounded are coming back. You can see them on the subway. But because Putin is paying them, the Kremlin is paying them, there's really not that many volunteers anymore. They're really seen as soldiers of fortune. So that war has never become a national war, despite the Kremlin assurances.
Can you offer any more details on what you were saying about Russians trying not to think about what the Kremlin is doing and how this war doesn't seem to have an end?
Russians, for example, they go into museums for a day. You face art and go to the exhibits that are wonderful. You go to a bookstore and you kind of read a book and have coffee and pretend that there is no Putin. So there's many other ways of doing it. So people just try to ignore that top-down reality. It's almost like the war ideology is almost like communism in the Soviet Union. After a while, you just shake it off and shrug it off and continue with your own life. And that's what many Russians are doing right now.
So turning back to the takeaways from the Alaska summit, Nina, a lot of people saw that as a real victory for Russia, with Putin effectively stepping out of international pariah status. How far do you think Moscow has come in terms of achieving the kind of long-term global legitimacy it has sought really for so long?
Well, I don't think Russia was a pariah the way the West saw it, because you've seen Putin travel to Saudi Arabia and he talks to Narendra Modi. He's dealing with Erdogan, Xi Jinping. So it's the Western world he was a pariah. But one of the points that he was making at the beginning is that the West doesn't run the world. So for him, that's sort of a proof in many ways. But we're also seeing with Trump is that the Western leaders, he's treating them not well, and they're calling him the daddy, as Mark Rutte did, or Ursula von der Leyen is smiling when he's ripping the countries off with the tariffs. And look at the tough guys, Xi Jinping, Narendra Modi, Vladimir Putin. These are the guys that Trump respects. So in many ways, Putin has never become that pariah. I mean, the war is difficult for the world, but because the West jumped so quickly on demolishing Russia or kind of declaring the strategic defeat of Russia, actually didn't really work well with other countries. And for Putin's legitimacy, it's legitimate enough what has been. But the fact that there was a red carpet from the United States, so basically will show them fake Western liberals, will show them the hypocrites of democratic parties, how the tough guys do it. So, and that certainly has achieved.
Nina Khrushcheva is a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She's also the co-author of the book, In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. Nina, thank you very much for speaking with us, as always.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we go to South America for politics and music. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Bolivia has had one ruling party for more than two decades. That is coming to an end. Yesterday, in the first round of a presidential vote, Bolivians handed an unprecedented rebuke to the longstanding Movement Towards Socialism Party, or MAS. MAS candidates were knocked out of the race, leaving two candidates from other parties to face each other in a final vote in October. They include a centrist lawmaker from a prominent political family, Senator Rodrigo Paz, who rallied his supporters on election night.
Empezamos a construir la victoria de la patria para cambiar, transformar, para hacer un país más igual, un país de sociedad iguales. Acompáñenme a decir que viva Bolivia.
Paz welcomed the results from the first round of voting, promising change, transformation, and a more equal society. The other candidate to emerge is a right-wing former president, Jorge Tuto Quiroga. The MAS party that had governed Bolivia since the early 2000s is now facing a frustrated public because of the struggling economy and various political scandals. The presidential runoff in Bolivia is scheduled for October 19th.
De olhos fechados, peço que alguém me ajude a salvar os domingos dessa ressaca da malha gasta do dengo que não vem.
If you're not familiar with her music already, allow us to introduce you to Lineker. Her full name, Lineker Gibajus Ferreira Campos. The Latin Grammy winner and soul icon has been trailblazing a path all her own since 2015.
Longe se mora, léguas daqui, depois pra lá de Londres.
Lineker's latest record is called Caju. It is groundbreaking work for this artist, not just musically, but also personally. She spoke about it with my co-host, Carolyn Beeler.
The whole album, it's a very dance and soul album that I tried to guide the people who listen to a place when it's possible to be yourself, to a place when it's possible to get your things and put yourself in perspective and go on.
The track we just listened to has this driving beat, but your vocals are so smooth. They kind of flow around the beat in this very soothing way. It is both kind of dancey and chill at the same time. How do you think of the mood of the music?
The mood is something like, could it be a dance song? Could it be a pop song? Could it be just a song to listen and to pay attention? And it's been very interesting the way that I've been received the POV from everybody saying, oh my gosh, in your album in Caju, I can dream, I can dance, I can fall in love. I think as an artist, listening to something like this is so special.
Não ligo se faz frio ou faz calor. Hoje quem me ligar, digo que tô nas nuvens de poeta ou algo assim. Torcendo pra não ser mentira enquanto você dorme.
You have said that with this new album, Caju, you're moving into new personal territory and kind of stepping into a greater sense of security in yourself, in your narrative, in your music. Caju is a sort of alter ego that you created for this album. Can you talk about that alter ego and why you thought that was a useful technique for creating this album?
I think that see Caju as a character helped me to say things that I don't have too much courage to say. I'm not just a person living this, but I think that sometimes we have to build some realities to going on and to help understand things. It's interesting as a process. I'm not living myself as an alter ego, but I think that in this process with Caju, I needed to do.
What are the kinds of things you could write about or say in this album as Caju and not as Lineker?
So I want to live a love. I want to be cared. I want to be the person who received a call saying, so the day was special and I was feeling your fault. And I think that sometimes as a person, as a Lineker, I don't have time to wonder in these things. And as a character, maybe I could create this imaginary to myself.
Specifically about finding love?
I think. Because I don't know if you know, but I'm a trans person and a black person, and it's very difficult for us sometimes to find love like this. So if in person is difficult, maybe a character could help me to find this.
Interesting. I want to go back a little bit and talk about your early days as a musician. You started writing music when you were a teenager, and you became relatively famous pretty quickly after your first single got a lot of attention. You were what, about 19 years old?
19, yes.
So how did that very quick rise to fame impact you?
Was it stressful? I was very insecure about a lot of things, but I'm happy and I'm feeling blessed, and now this year I'll complete 10 years of career, and I learned a lot. I changed my life. I changed the life of my family, and I'm not doing this for me, but I'm doing this for my community too, and that is important.
You recently recorded a song written by another Brazilian legend, Gilberto Gil. I want to listen to a bit of that. This song is When the Wind Blows.
When the wind blows south and the sun is shining bright, everything is feeling fresh and new.
So there's an interesting backstory here. Gilberto Gil wrote the song in 1982 and recorded it, but never released it until you got a hold of it. How did you know about the song?
So he sent a message to me. And he said that he had this song and was a gift to me as a young artist, being recognized by the great Gilberto Gil, and released this song right now at this moment of my life and my career.
Right on the storm.
That is not the first time that very big names in Brazilian music have kind of reached out to you, brought you under their wing. The samba singer Elza Soares, you have also toured with. You said that she was something of a mentor. What was that like, being kind of brought into the fold of the greatest musicians of your country early on in your career?
I feel so blessed because I love those peoples, and I love those peoples before being famous. I love those peoples because they help me and teach me how to listen good song, how to write good music, and I love them. They are amazing.
Você já decorou quantas tatuagens tenho? Se eu ligo pra Cartoon ou rabisco os meus desenhos, quantos shows tem na minha agenda, meu disco favorito.
Brazilian singer Lineker there, speaking with my co-host Carolyn Beeler. That new album, again, it's called Caju.
No samba, sei que samba, o que será que faz chorar? Será que você sabe que no fundo eu tenho medo de correr sozinho e nunca alcançar? Eu me encho de esperança de algo novo que aconteça. Quem despertar a rosa estará lá pro que aconteça. Num dia sou carente, completar suficiente. Quero amor correr.
More global news and stories still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Canada's Labour Relations Board said today that the Air Canada strike is illegal and ordered 10,000 flight attendants back to work. The union members had already ignored a previous return-to-work order yesterday. The strike at Canada's largest airline is in its third day now, tying up the travel plans of Air Canada's daily 130,000 passengers. The union and the company remain far apart on pay and other issues. It was not immediately clear what recourse the board or the Canadian government has if the flight attendants union refuses to call off the strike. Our northern neighbors play a somewhat surprising role in our next story. It's about the Missouri-born pop star Chapel Roan.
I know you wanted me to stay, but I can't ignore the crazy visions of me in LA.
From Los Angeles to Tennessee, the Midwest Princess, as she's known, has name-checked a number of spots across the U.S. in her lyrics. But in her latest single, Roan points fans to a place on the other side of the northern border, and it had an effect, as we hear from the world's Bianca Hillier.
If you're dialed in to pop music, you might have heard Roan's new song called The Subway. She sings about spotting her ex on the train and struggling to get over the breakup. Then she makes a deal with herself. She's moving to Saskatchewan, the Canadian province between Alberta and Manitoba.
You know, it's really exciting. We're honored to get a lyrical shout out from such a talented artist.
Jennifer Johnson works for Saskatchewan's capital city, Regina. She says residents there are getting a kick out of the mention, and people around the world are talking about it.
We're seeing more interactions on social media, and there's been over 6,000 mentions with an approximate reach of 6.6 million people talking about Saskatchewan, talking about Regina, all in relation to the song.
Johnson says there's also been an increase in Google searches for people wanting to pay a visit. And she adds, there's plenty to do. In Regina, tourists can go see the skeleton of Scotty the T-Rex, who's thought to be the largest T-Rex ever found. There's also plenty of lakes and parks across the province. Just make sure you visit in the next couple of months.
It takes a slightly brave soul to want to really experience Regina in the winter.
The spring, summer, and fall, though, are known to be really lovely.
You know what? It's about time Saskatchewan get recognized globally.
In an interview with Apple Music, Chapel Roan revealed why she set her sights on the province.
Because, like, it rhymed.
Of course. Gone rhymes with her pronunciation of Saskatchewan, which Johnson says is a just fine way to say it. The Canadian province, though, is far from the first place to see a surge in attention after being mentioned in a song.
Penny Lane.
Fans have flocked to Penny Lane in Liverpool, England, ever since the 1967 hit by the Beatles. Before that, the girl from Ipanema drew people to Brazil's beaches, and in the 80s, the song Down Under boosted Australia's profile across the globe. Time will tell if Saskatchewan sees the same impact, but at the very least, it seems like they may get a Chapel Roan concert.
I've never been there, but I promise I will perform there one day.
But I'm still counting down all of the days.
For now, fans are crossing their fingers, hoping the pop star will make good on her promise. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Negotiations aimed at getting a global plastics treaty fell apart last week, leaving us with very big questions about the hundreds of thousands of tons of plastic produced every year. In our coverage, we spoke with Amy Youngman with the Environmental Investigations Agency in Geneva.
For countries in the global north, they often outsource their waste generation problem and consumption problem to countries in the global south. And that's where we see a lot of illegal dumping. It lands in the rivers and in the waterways that take it to the ocean, as well as, you know, toxic burning for things like tofu production or food production, wow, for example, in Indonesia.
Yes, burning plastic to make tofu. That comment caught some attention, and we wanted to follow up. We asked Gauri Pathak in Mumbai to explain it. She studies how people interact with plastics. She told us plastics are particularly effective for starting fires for tofu production.
You have to boil the soy milk in order to make the tofu, and a lot of this plastic waste is being fed into boilers in order to produce the heat to boil that soy milk.
What kind of scale are we talking about here? Is using plastic as a fuel for tofu production an industry-wide practice?
No. So pretty much the thing with using plastic waste for tofu, there is plastic waste being burned in Java, in Indonesia, where they have these tofu factories. And that tofu is mostly being sold within the country. It's not, of course, standard practice. It's not even good practice. But the plastic waste, for one, is cheaper than using wood for burning. What is also happening is that a lot of these factories are actually getting waste paper from recycling companies. Now, a lot of these paper imports are actually contaminated with plastic waste.
I mean, that kind of answers the question, why use plastic at all as a fuel? But it sounds like there's a lot of confusion because plastic is kind of in everything.
It is, but this is specifically plastic waste. So the plastic waste is really entering Indonesia, largely, as your earlier speaker said, in the form of waste imports from the global north.
Gauri, how do you see plastic as a fuel source being used in Mumbai, where you are doing research?
Right. So luckily, it's not, at least in my research, I've not come across it being used as a fuel source. It's more that we see the open burning of mixed plastic waste. A lot of this is happening because you have all of this plastic waste. You do not have mechanisms for dealing with it. A lot of time, we really focus on litter as pollution, and we're not really talking about the upstream and other forms of pollution or harms of plastics that you get. That results in communities, individuals, localities, neighborhoods. They collect all of this. There are cleanup drives, and then they don't know what to do with all of this plastic waste. Mm. And the way to seemingly get rid of it is to just burn it.
Can you just give us an example of the upstream plastic many of us are ignoring?
I mean, basically, plastics are produced from fossil fuels. So when we use a lot of plastics, we are perpetuating a dependence upon a fossil fuel economy. And the other thing is that you have a lot of additives that are put into various types of plastics. Some of these additives are endocrine disrupting chemicals. During use, they can leach out of plastics. They do have effects on both human health, and they are contaminating our environments.
Gary, what are the health consequences for people who are working near or living near burning plastic, whether it's for tofu production or any other use?
The thing with the burning of plastics and exposure to that is there's shorter-term effects and there's a lot of longer-term effects. So in the short term, you have like coughing, you have respiratory issues, but there's longer-term effects. So one is that you have toxic emissions, you have gases such as dioxins, you have black carbon, which is a major contributor to air pollution as well. You can have heavy metals being released. We know that, for example, free-range chickens that are feeding around these areas are actually showing the presence of dioxins, and they are passing wow. on these dioxins through their eggs, through the meat, so people who are eating it, and then obviously it's, you know, moving on into the food chain from there. And all of these compounds, they have long-term effects. They can cause reproductive issues, hormonal issues. Some of them are carcinogens, so they can cause cancer. They can cause immune dysfunction. So a lot of systemic health issues that come from there.
So getting back to the dumping of plastic in the global south, and now they're awashing the stuff and they're struggling to deal with it. How much plastic is sent to Southeast Asia from other countries?
So at one point in time, most of the plastic that was supposedly being recycled in the global north was actually being sent to China. China introduced a ban on plastic waste imports in 2018. That meant that a lot of that waste was being sent over to other countries like Vietnam and Indonesia and others. A lot of them are introducing bans of their own. So Indonesia also introduced a ban on plastic waste imports at the beginning of this year, actually. So the problem is that now that it's illegal, we can't really tell because, one, we're still trying to figure out like how much of this is being enforced. So it's really hard to quantify what is coming through now.
Question, if plastic is now everywhere, like in chickens passing it on through their eggs, there are microplastics on top of the world on Mount Everest. Is it possible to know what country's citizens are most impacted by plastic?
No, I think it depends about like what kind of exposure we're talking about. If you're talking about exposure to plastic burning, the people who are working with these plastics and are actually the closest to the burning are the most affected. But on the other hand, we are all exposed to microplastics because it's entering us through things like the tea bags that are releasing these microplastics into our tea. It's in coffee cups that have like, you know, paper cups lined with plastic, all of those things. So we are all exposed to microplastics. I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that we can just protect ourselves or if we can think that we're safe because we are in the global north or somewhere that is not Indonesia, for example, or China or India or anywhere else.
Who's actually accountable for these types of plastics that just cannot be recycled?
The plastic industry is a big industry. So it's not just the petrochemical companies. There's companies that actually make the sort of plastic resin into packaging. They're also going to resist regulation. But I mean, recycling, as I said, oftentimes what is happening to your recycling is that it's being burned in these ways. A lot of times people think the solution is to move to biodegradable materials or like bioplastics, but those are problematic too. What you really want to do is move away from thinking in terms of substituting materials to think about substituting processes. Like how can we encourage reuse? How can we encourage reduction? How can we, for example, encourage refill behaviors or reusable forms of packaging?
Gauri Patak is an anthropologist at Aarhus University in Denmark. She joined us from Mumbai, where she's researching how humans interact with plastics. In Turkey, a journalist is on trial for reporting the results of a poll. The survey in question determined that a majority of Turkish voters are opposed to their president remaining in power for life. The defendant in this case is one of 17 journalists and media workers currently imprisoned in Turkey. But from behind bars, he has found a new way to get his voice out there. The world's Duri Baskaran has our story from Istanbul.
For many journalists around the world, imprisonment is a form of silencing. But 2 days after the arrest of 62-year-old Fatih Ataylı, hundreds of thousands of people tuned in to a YouTube video of his empty chair.
Selamlar Fatih Bey diyerek başlayacağım ve Fatih Bey'in de haftanın ilk günü Emre'cim. Bugün
in a statement written from prison and read out loud by an unnamed producer, Ataylı denied threatening or insulting Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, charges for which he is now being held in a high-security prison on the outskirts of Istanbul. The penalty could be up to 4 years behind bars. Banu Tuna is General Secretary of the Turkish Journalist Syndicate. If you had told anyone in Turkey 20 years ago that Fatih Ataylı would one day be in prison, they would say it's impossible, Tuna says. It's like the world being turned upside down. Back then, Ataylı worked in radio. Later, he wrote for Hürriyet, one of the biggest papers in the country. He covered sports, Formula One, and the news. He wasn't overly political. He was a man of the system for many years, says Tuna. Ataylı eventually rose to editor-in-chief of the major newspaper Sabah, But he resigned after the paper ran into financial trouble and was seized by the government in 2007. The paper was then sold to a holding company close to the government. Now, about 90% of mainstream Turkish media is controlled by pro-government entities, according to Reporters Without Borders. He found himself outside the system, Tuna says. And like many of our colleagues, he opened his own space for free expression on YouTube.
Oradaki zaten bu şaşırtıcı bir şeydi. Yani biraz izanı ve biraz vicdanı.
His audience stayed loyal, with more than 1.6 million subscribers. Fatih Atayla's channel is a mix of politics, sports commentary, and long-form interviews. In this video, he test drives a Lexus.
Kırmızı yanısı ısıtmadır, mavi yanısı soğutmadır.
Macho, sert, kavgacı.
His style is a bit macho, hard, like a fighter, Tuna says. Atayla's tongue was always sharp. While imprisoned, Atayla's production team has continued to post videos on his channel, reading his letters from prison over an image of his empty chair, and having guests appear for interviews while a disembodied voice asks the questions.
Hakkınızda gözaltı kararı var, bizimle gelmeniz gerekiyor, dediler.
Atayla is one of dozens of journalists who have been detained since the March arrest of Istanbul's mayor, a political rival of President Erdogan. Last week, authorities launched a new investigation against Atayla, accusing him of publicly disseminating misleading information and attempting to block his YouTube channel. First, journalists are arrested, and then authorities attempt to find criminal connections, says Gökhan Durmuş, president of the Turkish Journalists Union. In the meantime, they spend months in prison.
Yüksek bir ihtimalle her üçü de serbest bırakılacaklar ve beraat edecekler davada.
There's a high probability that everyone will be released and acquitted, Durmuş says. But they still spent those months in prison. While he's behind bars, Atayla is giving listeners a window into life in a mega prison, Banu Tuna says. In one anecdote, he mixed apricot juice and mineral water into a mocktail and went sunbathing in the prison yard. With everyone who's been accused of being a terrorist and getting arrested and going in and out of prison, it's already begun to stop being such a boogeyman, Tuna says. Here, too, life goes on.
Bir kahramanlık gerektirmemeli aslında.
Tuna says that for Turkish journalists, the profession is heroic, but it shouldn't require you to be a hero. Circumstances impose it on people. Last week, Tuna remembers telling a press freedom group that she felt like a cockroach. You know, it's the only animal that can survive a nuclear attack, she laughs. No matter what happens to us, we're still here, popping out from underground. For The World, I'm Derya Buscarin. Istanbul.
A country in conflict where centuries-old historic documents need protection. Just ahead, how people in Mali are pulling off that rescue act right now. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thousands of ancient documents have been returned to the city of Timbuktu in Mali. They arrived last week on the backs of flatbed trucks. Historically, Timbuktu, or Tumbuktu as it's also known, had been a wealthy center of learning and trade in West Africa. That was centuries ago before it became synonymous with end-of-the-earth remoteness. Then, a little over a decade ago, Al-Qaeda affiliates took over Timbuktu and destroyed much of the city's UNESCO World Heritage Sites and, in the process, burning some ancient manuscripts in the city's library archives. Now the documents have returned to Timbuktu, but at a tenuous moment for the military junta in charge of the country, there is the continued militant threat and a recent coup plot that was foiled. Ulf Lesing is an expert on the Sahel region in Africa with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. He's based in Mali's capital, Bamako.
Timbuktu, like you mentioned, was a major city of learning in West Africa. And that time, everybody wanted to go there to study anything. It was really a sign of advancement and everything was written down in these ancient manuscripts. Unfortunately, some thousands were destroyed when the Al-Qaeda affiliate of jihadists came, but the rest was saved, was smuggled out during the Islamist occupation by trucks, by boat, and put in a storage in Bamako. Now they're being returned to Timbuktu.
Right. What is contained in the documents? What kind of subject matter?
Yeah, anything about science, about mathematics, about engineering, about languages, about religious studies, basically anything. People were just putting knowledge down on these scripts and preserve knowledge from that time when Timbuktu was a major center in the Muslim world and in West Africa of learning, where scholars from all over the Muslim world trekked there to study.
So they were smuggled out of Timbuktu over a decade ago and brought to the Malian capital, Bamako. Where had they been guarded, and why have they now returned to Timbuktu?
Now they're being returned because for the military government, this is important to showcase that they're really in charge of the north, which is still very much, yeah, not controlled, but where jihadists were very active. They control the countryside in the north. So it's a symbolic move by the government to move them back to showcase their control, the situation in the north and in Timbuktu.
I mean, more than a decade ago, Timbuktu was under the temporary control of Islamist militants. They were not in the city for long, but they did destroy some of the city's historic sites and thousands of those ancient documents. Jihadists are still in the region. How safe is the city today, though? And what is the risk faced by the documents and anyone taking care of them?
Well, I mean, the city is under government control. There's the army and also Russian mercenaries are there. But on the countryside, Al-Qaeda is pretty much active. A few weeks ago, they staged an attack over in parts of the cities for a couple of hours. So, yeah, I hope they are safe. I mean, they were kept previously with families who had guarded them for centuries, so they're in safe hands. But, yeah, obviously, it's hard to say with security in Timbuktu. The city generally is safe, but there is a risk of attacks. But there's no sign that jihadists now target, you know, these manuscripts. They're more focused on attacking military targets such as army camps or, you know, sites of the Russian mercenaries, not so much museums or manuscripts.
I read that climatic conditions in Bamako were not good for these documents. What's the situation like in Timbuktu? It's pretty dry, isn't it?
Yeah, generally it's a very hot country. There isn't really much of a winter. Obviously, storage conditions are never ideal. There's a lot of electricity cuts in the south, even on the north, all over the country. So climatization is an issue. But on the other hand, these manuscripts, they have survived for more than 700 years in similar conditions. So I'm not so much concerned about storage. I mean, that should be okay. The bigger risk is security as such.
So looking at the wider security picture that Mali's military junta is facing right now, the military junta there kicked out the French military and UN peacekeepers a couple of years ago. Does it look like the military junta is just going it alone?
Well, they kind of allied themselves with Russia, inviting more than 1,000 mercenaries from the previous Wagner group. Now they call themselves Africa Corps. And they've been doing the job of the French fighting jihadists, not very successfully. I mean, that's pretty bad, especially in the north center. But also most recently, we have seen attacks in the south. That might be another reason why the government is now moving these manuscripts north to really showcase its population. They're trying to fix the country's woes. But yeah, the situation as such, the security situation, remains pretty grim.
So you mentioned Russian mercenaries, Wagner Group, which, as you said, now has kind of rebranded as Africa Corps. They announced earlier this summer that they were leaving the country soon after, quote, completing mission. Have they, though?
No, it was more like a PR stunt. I mean, the Wagner Group was from the time when the Russian state was not fully in control. It was run by Mr. Prigozhin, who was the founder of the Wagner Group, like a Russian warlord.
Right.
The Russian government had kept these old contracts between Mali and the Wagner Group intact because it was all based on Prigozhin's personal contracts. Now these mercenaries, they're still there. They now got new contracts. They work for the Africa Corps, not the Wagner Group. But apart from that, nothing really has changed.
You mentioned a moment ago the concerning security situation in the south of Mali. There was a coup attempt reported last week in the capital. What do we know as of right now about that?
It's hard to find out what exactly happened, but I mean, dozens of officers were apparently taken into custody, and the government issued a statement that some people had tried to undermine the transition. That's all we know so far. I mean, Mali, unfortunately, is famous for coups. This government is now in place for 5 years, this military government. But yeah, there have been many coups in Mali and also in neighboring countries before. That's the way to go to change the government, not through elections, rather by some officers taking matters into their hands.
So, Ulf, just on the documents, I mean, you're based in Bamako. I'm curious, what kind of value did the Malian people put on these documents in terms of like how they see their own history?
Malians are extremely proud of their country. It's often like people in Europe, America look down a bit on Africa. This is that claiming that they didn't really have a cultural heritage. That's definitely not true. I mean, like we can see Timbuktu was a center of learning at a time when in Europe things weren't really progressing. So it's part of the national heritage. People are proud about it. And yeah, they're part of the national heritage.
Do you think Malians are confident that these documents will be safe again in Timbuktu?
Well, that's what local leaders say. And I mean, I'm sure if they return them to the families who had been keeping them for centuries, they want to preserve these manuscripts. If they wanted to get rid of them to sell them, they would have done it a long time ago or destroy them. So yeah, I'm relatively confident that they will do everything to keep the manuscripts safe if the city as such also stays safe.
Ouf Lesing is an expert on the Sahel region in West Africa with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. He's based in Mali's capital, Bamako. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you as always for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Alisa and Mike Wilson, Carol Bushka, Eugene G. Park, Lisa and Peter Kraus, Ricky Etherly, and Robert Lang. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.